The last book in the Bible, the book of Revelation, is a book that I imagine many of us are intrigued by. We read its symbolism, the different imagery, and sometimes we don't know what to do with it. In today's podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Tom Schreiner, who's recently released a couple of books on the book of Revelation, and he's going to be helping us to think about how we should read the book, but also its relevance for the Christian life. And I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Center for Christian Living podcast. On today's episode, we're very privileged to be joined by Tom Schreiner. Tom is the James Buchanan Harrison Professor of New Testament Interpretation at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Tom, thank you very much for being on the podcast. Before we dive into our topic, which is on the book of Revelation, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your journey, how you became a Christian, how you ended up lecturing at Southern Seminary.
Yeah, I was raised in a Catholic family. I'm from the West Coast, the state of Oregon. I was converted through the person who's now my wife when I was 17 years old. I'd never really heard the gospel until I met her. I immediately felt a call to ministry. I thought I would be a full-time pastor. I have pastored, but I thought I would do that full-time. But as I studied, I realized that God had given me inclinations to do further study and work. So now I'm in my 41st year of teaching, amazingly. Wow.
So we're thinking about the book of Revelation, and you've actually written three books on Revelation, two commentaries, and a book on the themes of Revelation in Crossway's New Testament Theology series. In that volume, you make the observation that the book of Revelation both attracts and repels readers. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think this is perhaps a bad illustration or analogy, but it reminds me a little bit of reading, if people know the short stories of Edgar Allan Poe. They're fascinating, but they're full of images and sometimes shocking images and symbolism that can be off-putting. But I still remember the first time I read Revelation. At the same time, there's something transcendent about the book that draws us in, and you sense an excitement and the great cosmic conflict going on, which I think also attracts readers. But it's hard for readers because we wonder, what in the world is he saying?
People have often observed that the Old Testament is one of the key assumptions that the reader makes. Do you think it's fair that one of the reasons maybe we find it hard to read Revelation is we don't pick up on the Old Testament references that John is making in the book?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I was actually texting with an Old Testament scholar about my book, and I texted him and I said, one of the primary reasons we struggle with Revelation is we don't know the Old Testament. As you know, Peter, virtually every verse has an allusion to the Old Testament. And generally speaking, we're quite ignorant of the Old Testament. And there's a tendency, at least in some modern circles, to read the book of Revelation via the newspaper, or maybe I should say now the internet. People don't read newspapers anymore. And at least to read it in terms of contemporary events. And instead, our hermeneutical foundation should be really the Old Testament scriptures.
So one writer on Revelation has said that they think that John uses the Old Testament compositionally rather than expositionally. I know that's getting a little bit technical, but it's almost as if the language of the Old Testament is his vocabulary as he writes. Do you think that's a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that quotation before, or if I'd read it, I'd missed it. But I thought it was quite insightful, actually, that, yeah, he's not. I mean, there is exposition of the Old Testament, but not per se. I mean, often John takes the Old Testament language and tweaks it in his own direction. So I think it's almost as if he's leading the Old Testament as he's writing.
Yeah.
And that's a nice way of putting it, that it's compositionally, because we don't have just a straightforward exegesis of these Old Testament texts, but they're bursting out all over as he gives us his message.
Yeah. And the message of Revelation, we'll think about that message in a few moments, but What type of literature is the book of Revelation, would you say?
Yes. Well, most scholars would agree that in Revelation, we have prophecy. John designates it as prophecy several times. Also, we have an epistolary genre in chapters 2 and 3. But what's most notable is that it's apocalyptic literature. And that apocalyptic literature, we find it in the Old Testament. Any of your listeners, just read Zechariah 9 through 14. And you might be as puzzled as you are when you read the book of Revelation. And we see it in some Second Temple literature as well, like First Enoch and other books that have been written, Second Baruch. So apocalyptic literature is characterized, I suppose the simplest way to put it, is quite symbolic. And that can be off-putting to readers. What do these symbols mean? How do we decipher them? How do we interpret them? How literally should we understand it? But at least if we understand the book is apocalyptic, we are spared the danger of trying to read it like an epistle or a narrative or poetry. It is a different genre, and that can be challenging to us as contemporary readers.
So any tips for how we interpret the symbolism when we sit down to read the book of Revelation and we're encountered with this very rich symbolism that John uses? Where can we go for help, or how do we read responsibly?
Yeah. I could say several things. One thing I'd say is there's the words of the text, then there's the symbol, and then there's a reference. Sometimes it's easy. So the opponent, here's an easy symbol. The opponent in chapter 13 is called a beast linguistically. Well, I don't know anyone who takes that literally. No one thinks the opponent is literally a beast or some kind of animal. So then we have to discover, well, what is the referent? As is so often the case, which we referred to earlier, the Old Testament is absolutely crucial. If we want to discern who this beast is, we've got to read Daniel 7, where these great world empires are also described in terms of various animals. So one of the keys to the symbolism, again, is knowing the Old Testament. But it's not always easy. I really struggled, like chapters 8 and 9, the trumpet judgments especially. Richard Bauckham points this out in his work. Many apocalyptic writers pause to explain the significance of the symbolism. And John does that at times. But in chapters 8 and 9, the trumpet judgment, nothing. And I was very curious as I was embarking on this project in terms of the history of interpretation, what people would say and how to interpret those symbols. And interpreters are all over the place, precisely because John doesn't tell us what the symbols mean. So is he talking about the natural world? Some people even see, you know, the natural phenomena that are described there in terms of false teaching. So the less John tells us, the more difficult it can become. On the other hand, when we think of the locust judgment, I mean, that's another example I think of in chapter 9. Clearly, they're not literal locusts, and John gives us some hints. For example, he tells us these locusts don't eat anything green. Yeah. And they have tails that sting human beings. Well, there's no such locust like that in the natural world. I think John is screaming to us, it's symbolic. But once again, we go back to the book of Joel, right?
Yeah.
Some passages are hard, like the two witnesses. So that is a very difficult passage in chapter 11, because are they two literal people? Some people have argued that. Or does it represent the church? It's harder to tell, because the beast, it's easy in a way. Well, we know that's a symbol. But the two witnesses now, that could easily be just two human beings. And many interpreters have argued that. I actually argue that it refers to the church, but there are many interpreters who've disagreed in the course of history.
There are lots of aspects, as you say, that have been discussed in church history. Perhaps the one that has had most significant discussion, perhaps particularly in the last 400 years or so, would be the millennium, mentioned in Revelation 20. Thoughts on what the millennium refers to?
Well, that's a very difficult issue, and I'm a very unstable person. I have actually held to a historic premillennial view, an amillennial view, and right now I'm proposing, along with a few others, in my commentary a view called New Creation Millennialism. I'm attracted to this view because it's sort of a via media between historic pre-mill and all millennialism. That doesn't mean it's right. Every view has problems.
So pre-millennialism is 1,000 years before Jesus comes back, a sort of interim, right? Do you want to just briefly flesh out the different positions for the listeners?
Well, yes. Let me explain them a little bit. So all millennialism believes that the millennium started at Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension. So we're in the millennium now. Satan was bound at the cross. The first resurrection in Revelation 20, the majority view today, that first resurrection in Revelation 20 refers to the intermediate state in heaven after death. I mean, Greg Beale argues this and others. So that is a long legacy in the history of the church, going back to Tychonius and Augustine and many others. The historic premillennial view is well attested in early church history with Papias, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus. The historic premillennial view is that Christ comes to earth at the second coming, and then there's 1,000 years, or that number is symbolic, a significant period of time in which Christ reigns on earth. And then at the end, Satan is released, and there's this great rebellion. So one of the features of the historic premill view is that there are both glorified and unglorified saints on earth. So the Apostle Paul's there, presumably, and people like us right now with unglorified bodies. So that's a very interesting feature. Now, there's dispensational premillennialism. I don't know if you want to talk about that. That's a particular kind of premillennialism that's very popular still in the United States, where you have a 7-year tribulation and there's the raptures before this tribulation. And the millennium focuses very much on Israel. That is not the typical historic premillennial view, though. You don't see that in the early fathers. I don't see any evidence in Revelation that the author is particularly concerned with ethnic Israel. So I don't think that view is very plausible. Mm. The postmillennial view is very close to the amillennial view. That when the millennium starts differs amongst postmillennial interpreters, but for some, it starts at the resurrection. The number 1,000 is taken as symbolic, and the world is progressively transformed by the power of the gospel. So that view is very popular amongst the Puritans. And, you know, in the United States, it's making a comeback in some circles today. Doug Wilson and the theonomy movement, that's rather popular. Exegetically, I've never been attracted to this view, but all these things are very complicated. So the new creation millennial view, which I'm espousing now, it is similar to the historic premill view in that it argues that the binding of Satan during the millennium is total, and it argues that the first resurrection in Revelation 20 is physical, which the amill, remember, say that resurrection is spiritual in the intermediate state. But it is similar to the amill view in that it argues that all these Old Testament passages like Isaiah 60 and Isaiah 2 and Isaiah 65, 17 through 25, refer to the new creation, not to the millennial period exclusively. Well, in my view, the millennium is the inauguration of the new creation. So therefore, it avoids a problem with the historic premillennial view. There are no unglorified saints on earth. So it's sort of a combination of the two views. I think one thing that's satisfying to me, I think it's a little more natural reading of Revelation 20. The amillennial view fits my theology and my reading of how John appropriates these Old Testament texts, like Ezekiel 40 through 48. So at least dispensationalists have said that's the building of the temple. Well, that passage, they'll say there might be a literal temple rebuilt in the millennium. But what's so interesting is John appropriates that passage in Revelation 21 and 22, not in the millennial text, but the new creation, which I think points to the truth that that temple is not a literal temple at all, but it's God's presence among his people. As Greg Beale would say, the whole world becomes his temple. I hope I'm not confusing everyone by going on about this, but let me say, every view has problems. in the new creation view, you have Satan after 1,000 years leading a rebellion. So some people will say, well, what do you mean we live in a new creation and then evil suddenly pops out again? And in the new creation view, who joined Satan? The dead, the wicked dead are resurrected and joined Satan in that rebellion. Eckhart Schnabel has argued for this. You know, John Gill, the historic Baptist writer, may have held something like this. When I've read him a little bit, it's a little bit hard to be sure. My answer to the objection is, why would such an attack even take place? It reveals the utter insanity of evil, for one thing. There's no hope of succeeding. We're in the new creation. And of course, they don't succeed. And the millennium is the first age of the new creation. After that, there is no further threat. Of course, the threat has no impact on the saints. But I acknowledge, yes, maybe that's not the easiest explanation. And I am not dogmatic about the millennium. So I'm not sure. We'll all find out. I always say to my friends over here, it can't be that important because it ends. It's not forever. So American evangelicals, we have tended to overemphasize this. Sometimes I feel like we're more excited about the millennium than the new creation.
Yeah, and that's very helpful that some of these difficulties we might have with reading the text, in a sense, they keep us humble as we keep working at the text and we're dependent on the Lord. We're also dependent on each other for insights. But as you say, the main message, the hope of the new creation, we'll talk about that in a second, is secure and front and center for us. If you've enjoyed this episode with Tom Schreiner, you might like to know that in August, Tom is coming to Sydney to deliver the annual Moore College Lectures. This is a lecture series that we have each year where we get a faculty member, or as in this case, a visiting scholar, to talk on an aspect of their research. And Tom is coming to speak to us about the book of Galatians. Tom's been writing on Galatians. He's previously published a commentary on Galatians. The lectures will happen at Moore College in the mornings of the week of the 5th to the 9th of August. And you can check out the Moore College website to find out more information on those. Join us for a Friday evening conversation on Friday the 9th of August with New Testament theologian Tom Schreiner from the USA and Moore faculty members Jane Tour and Dan Wu. The format for the evening will be that there won't be a talk. Instead, the entire time will be given to the panel answering any questions that you have on complementarianism. Please bring your questions about marriage, about the ministries of men and women, about gender complementarity. Come with friends, your Bible study group, or simply yourself. This will be an excellent way to finish the week. The sexualization of society is not new, but the untethering of sex from all relational foundations has posed new problems. No longer is sex between a man and a woman, or even between a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and nor is it even with another person you've met through an app. Sex can now be with whomever you want, in whatever way you want, even with non-human devices. Christians may not engage in these practices, but they are still immersed in the same cultural space. Our ideas of sex and sexuality can easily be shaped and changed by the world around us. How do we engage these topics in this new cultural space? How do we cling to what God in His Word says is good for sex and sexuality? How do we respond to those who say that it is time to let go of our beliefs in the name of progress? Join us as Philip Kern, head of New Testament at Moore College, brings us back to what the Bible says about relationships, our bodies, and sexuality. Philip has been working on a book about what the New Testament says about sex and sexuality. So it will be great to hear from him and his insights on this very important topic. And now let's get back to our program. I'm interested that your theology of revelation that you released a couple of years ago, you entitled it The Joy of Hearing. And when we think of Revelation, maybe that's not the first thing that we might think of as the theme of Revelation. Why did you entitle the book, The Joy of Hearing?
Yeah, John begins the book with the admonition to hear what is said. And that hearing is tied to, both at the beginning and the end of the book, and really throughout the book, to obedience. What does it mean to hear in the Hebrew scriptures and in the New Testament as well? Hearing isn't just hearing, but true hearing is a hearing that leads to obedience. And I call it the joy of hearing because hearing God's word and obeying it does bring us joy and it brings us happiness. And I think it connects with the major theme of Revelation, which is there's a great cosmic conflict going on, and it's going on right now for all of us, between good and evil, between God and Satan, between the beast and Jesus Christ and the false prophet and Babylon and so forth and so on. There's a great conflict. And John is saying, hear a transcendent message from above. Receive the meta narrative of what's going on right now and find joy in that and persevere in the faith. Hang on. Since the saints are suffering in Revelation, it makes a difference to persevere. Those who don't persevere will experience judgment. So I just wrote a little book on the final judgment, a little more popular book, which really came out of my study of Revelation.
And in terms of, we talked a lot about some of the details, the symbolism. Why do you think overall Revelation is an important book for Christians today? Obviously, some people want to read it in light of interpreting contemporary events, and maybe that's not a helpful way. But how do you see it as being a helpful book for Christians today?
Yes. First of all, I'd say Revelation shares with the rest of the New Testament a focus on the cross. We could even say it's very Trinitarian. The Father is the Creator, the Son as the Redeemer, and the Spirit, especially in Revelation, as the Revealer, as the one who discloses the truth to us. So I think some people, when they consider Revelation, it doesn't come to their mind. It's in accord with the rest of the New Testament on the work of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And the great work of the Father and the Son and the Spirit is the redemption of believers from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. God is accomplishing his universal purpose. He's fulfilling his promise to Abraham to bless all nations. And yet, there is a fierce and implacable opposition to this great redemption. And that opposition means that believers are suffering. And then if we look at the letters, what are the two things that are happening in the seven letters? There's conflict and there's compromise. So not all the churches are compromising. Smyrna and Philadelphia don't get a criticism, but there's conflict with the world and there's compromise with the world. And so I think that's the message of the book. You're in a great conflict. Be encouraged. You will triumph. At the end, you will conquer. You will win. You've already conquered, so to speak, if you belong to Christ. So hang on, and then don't compromise. And I think that's a very powerful message to us today, because when pressure comes, and I'm not a prophet, but the world's in a bad state today, when that pressure comes, we're tempted to compromise, just as the early church was. And he says in all the letters, this is for all the churches. And I interpret that, yes, it's for all seven of the churches, but it's also for all the churches of all time. The message is for us as well.
The book of Revelation ends with this wonderful picture of the new creation. As you've worked on that part of the book, I wonder how your faith has been strengthened as you've considered the new creation.
Yeah, it's such a lovely and beautiful and hope-giving picture. And I think that's the primary role it's played in my life. It's given me hope. And hope gives joy, right? That we have an assurance that we will see our God face to face. We enjoy fellowship with him now. But as John says in 1 John, we'll see him as he is. And I think that's the main purpose of the new creation, is our fellowship with God will be deeper and richer and more profound than it is now. And that's our hope, and it's a great encouragement to us. And then I would say Revelation seizes our imagination with these images, and he paints a picture of the new creation that it's inexpressibly beautiful and lovely. The gold and the pearls, all of that is designed to give us a picture of a beauty that perhaps the closest experience to it in life is listening to a very beautiful piece of music.
Wonderful. Well, Tom, we're very thankful for your time with us on the podcast. We're also very thankful for the work that you've done on this book. We have listeners from all over the place, but we have a number of listeners based in Sydney, where Moore College and the Center for Christian Living is based. And we're very much looking forward to your visit to Moore College in August. And you're going to be delivering the annual Moore College lectures on Galatians. Can you just give us a little bit of a teaser or a taster? What excites you about Paul's letter to the Galatians?
Yeah, well, Peter, I'm really looking forward to being with you. I think Galatians is fascinating because Paul's under attack and the gospel is under attack. In the first two chapters, Paul has to defend himself. To defend the gospel, he has to defend himself. And then in the midst of this opposition, where there's this conflict over what the nature of the gospel, he unpacks what the gospel is, and the gospel is our life. And then the last two chapters, he focuses on what does this mean for our daily lives, the power of the Spirit in our daily lives. So again, I'm very struck with Trinitarian things these days. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit play a central role in that gospel in Galatians.
Wonderful. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you, Lord willing, in August, and we're very thankful for your time on the podcast today. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Peter.
To benefit from more resources from the Center for Christian Living, please visit ccl.more.edu.au, where you'll find a host of resources, including past podcast episodes, videos from our live events, and articles published through the center. We'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast and for you to leave us a review so that more people can discover our resources. On our website, we also have an opportunity for you to make a tax-deductible donation to support the ongoing work of the center. We always benefit from receiving questions and feedback from our listeners, so if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at ccl@more.edu.au. As always, I'd like to thank Moore College for its support of the Center for Christian Living, and to thank my assistant, Karen Bailharts, for her work in editing and transcribing the episodes. The music for our podcast was generously provided by James West.